Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of Plan C, Ocean-Based Interventions to Combat Climate Change podcast series. I'm your host, Will Burns. I'm a visiting professor in the Environmental Policy and Culture Program at Northwestern University and a founding co-director of the Institute for Carbon Removal, Law, and Policy at American University. Plan C focuses on the potential role of so-called ocean-based climate geoengineering approaches, both in the context of carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management, from a scientific, technological, legal, and social perspective. The podcast series is supported by a generous grant from Additional Ventures, an organization that, among other things, focuses on the potential role of ocean-based carbon removal approaches to combat climate change. In our inaugural episode, we focused on the knotty questions associated with measurement, reporting, and verification of carbon sequestration from seaweed cultivation. And we returned back to the topic of seaweed in this episode, but with a focus this time on regulatory questions, primarily at the subnational level. In a recent piece published in the journal Frontiers in Climate, for which I served as a reviewer, Javier Lizon at the University of Oxford argued that the local dimension of regulation of coastal and ocean-based carbon dioxide removal is a critical and under-discussed topic. Because I agree, I'm regularly seeking out guests who can address this issue. And our guest for this episode, Romany Webb, is co-author of a new report that's right on point. The report, published by the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University, is entitled Permitting Seaweed Cultivation for Carbon Sequestration in California, Barriers and Recommendations. Romany serves as an associate research scholar at Columbia Law School and is a senior fellow at the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law. Romany, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So let's kick these off with a foundational question. Can you explain the potential ways that seaweed farming and cultivation might be developed to sequester carbon dioxide?
Yeah, well, much like trees and other terrestrial plants, kelps and other types of seaweed absorb carbon dioxide as they grow. The plants convert that carbon dioxide into organic carbon. Some of that organic carbon ends up in the sediments below where the seaweed grows, but most of it actually ends up in the plants themselves, in the biomass. And so scientists have proposed that we sink the seaweed plants and that would sequester that organic carbon that they contain, potentially for really long periods of time. In order for this to work effectively, we need to get the seaweed plants deep enough such that as the organic carbon they contain starts to remineralize back into carbon dioxide, it doesn't come into contact with the atmosphere and sort of re-enter the atmosphere. But provided we do that, we could be effectively sort of drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it in the deep ocean for tens or hundreds of years. Some scientists have also proposed that we cultivate or grow seaweed and then harvest it for use as a food or fuel source. So we could, for example, use seaweed to make biofuels that then we could use to replace fossil fuels. We could use it in place of animal proteins, in food products. Both of those things would reduce carbon dioxide emissions because we'd be replacing a more carbon-intensive product. But they wouldn't achieve that sort of net negative emissions or actual carbon removal in the same way as sinking the seaweed would. And still a need for a lot of research into whether we can do this at a really large scale, what the environmental impacts will be, and exactly how much carbon we can sequester for how long. But it does appear to be quite a promising technique.
All right. Thanks for that. So let's get into the regulatory aspects and in California. So, you know, California, often a leader on the cutting edge when it comes to environmental issues, and certainly no exception in the context of climate change. Lots of creative proposals have been coming out from California, including in terms of carbon removal. And obviously, one of the things that they've been discussing is the potential role of seaweed. Can you explain what California's been looking at in terms of those approaches that you discussed, and how they contemplate that it it plays a role in their regulatory framework.
Yeah, well, California could, at least in theory, be really an ideal location for seaweed cultivation. You know, the state has a long coastline. The waters off the coast, near to the coast, are really ideally suited to growing seaweed because they have the right sort of light levels, right nutrient levels, temperature, etc. And as you said, Will, California has really been a leader from a legal and policy perspective in efforts to address climate change. They have these very ambitious climate goals, including a goal of achieving carbon neutrality or net zero emissions by 2045. Earlier this year, the California Air Resources Board released a draft scoping plan that sets out how they plan to achieve that goal. And they recognize in that plan that they will need to deploy carbon removal technologies at a very, potentially a very large scale to actually achieve carbon neutrality. They also recognize, though, that the existing sort of carbon removal industry is still quite nascent and that a lot of work is going to need to be put into sort of scaling it up in a short period of time. The scoping plan doesn't specifically mention seaweed cultivation as one of the carbon removal techniques they might use, but there is a lot of private sector interest in developing new seaweed farms along the California coast. You know, in developing the report that you mentioned, we spoke to a lot of industry folks who are interested in creating new farms there because it has these ideal growing conditions. But currently the regulatory framework isn't particularly conducive to that. It's really complicated. It's really time consuming and costly for people to actually get the permits they need to develop these farms.
Okay, let's get into that if we can. Can you talk about what the regulatory framework for seaweed cultivation would probably look like in California, and then why you and the co-authors of this report kind of deem that problematic?
Yeah, I think the key where we land in terms of why it's problematic is developers who are wanting to develop new farms in California waters need to obtain multiple permits from multiple state and federal agencies under multiple state and federal laws. And so that structure creates this very complicated permitting framework. It's very difficult for developers to navigate and imposes overlapping and often duplicative requirements. So just to give you an idea, usually, you know, the process from a developer's point of view is divided into three key steps. The first step is for the developer to go to the California Fish and Game Commission and request a lease to use the sort of water column and the seabed to develop their seaweed farm. The submission of that application triggers a requirement to do an environmental review under the California Environmental Quality Act, which is basically the state equivalent of NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And under that state act, state and local agencies have to prepare what's called an environmental impact report before undertaking or authorizing any activity that would have significant environmental effects. A lot of proposed seaweed farms might have those sorts of significant environmental effects. So you go through the environmental review process, prepare this very comprehensive environmental impact report. Once that's done, the California Fish and Game Commission can issue a lease if it decides that's in the public interest. But even with that lease in hand, the developer can't yet start developing their farm. They still have to go through a second process that's called a multi-agency permitting process, where they obtain other state and federal permits that they need to develop their farm. And depending on the nature of the farm and where it's located, they might actually need several different permits from several different agencies. So the whole process is very cumbersome, very expensive, and very time-consuming. Usually to go through the environmental review process and to obtain the lease from the California Fish and Game Commission, that can take about 5 years. The multi-agency permitting process can take another 5 years. So you're looking at 10 years just stuck in the permitting process before you can develop your farm.
Yeah, and I take it there has been some efforts to do this in the past, right, where we have some empirical evidence that the process can be that protracted?
Yeah, some of the developers that we spoke to and the industry folks that we spoke to had this experience. There were farms where, you know, developers were looking at developing off the California coast and abandoned their plans because the permitting process was taking too long. So it's clear that this is a real issue. Currently, I think there's only two commercial open water seaweed farms off the California coast. A lot of other states, you know, we looked specifically at Maine and Alaska, which Alaska has, I think, around 20 active farms. Maine has about 30 active farms. So there are other places where these farms, developers are choosing to go to those other places instead.
Right. And you talked about cost associated with this process. Could you give the listener some sense of what the costs of the regulatory process might be in California at this point?
Yeah, there are fees that developers have to pay when they apply for, say, a lease or the other permits they have. Those fees are actually relatively modest, but the environmental review process can be really incredibly expensive. You know, we heard reports of people paying $500,000 for that environmental review process. So it can be a real barrier, particularly for, you know, smallish developers who want to do small farms, who want to experiment with different types of seaweed to see what grows well where and how much carbon they can sequester with different varieties.
Okay. So you already alluded to Alaska and Maine. And in your report, you describe the regulatory approaches in these two states as potentially providing us with another way of both effectuating effective regulation, but at the same time facilitating seaweed cultivation at scale, potentially. Could you talk about the different approaches in Alaska and Maine?
Yeah, so both of those states have seen sort of higher levels of seaweed development in recent years. And one reason we argue for that is that the permitting process is sort of more straightforward, certainly much quicker. You know, as I said, in California, it can take 10 years to get a project fully permitted. I think in Alaska, the average time is about a year, and in Maine, it's about 1 to 2 years. So it's a much quicker process. Each state has taken a somewhat different approach. Alaska is similar to California in that developers do have to obtain multiple permits from multiple agencies. But one of the good things they've done in Alaska is that they allow developers to obtain all of those permits through a single application process. So the developer just submits one application that goes to all of the relevant state agencies. All of the state agencies review that application sort of in parallel and then issue the permits if they deem that appropriate. And so the whole process tends to go much faster than in California, where developers first have to apply for that lease. And only if that lease is granted can they then start applying for the other approvals they need. The situation in Maine is a little bit different. They've basically sort of allocated all of the responsibility for issuing approvals for seaweed farms to a single state agency. So developers don't have to deal with multiple agencies. And the other thing that they've done in Maine is that they've created basically different classes of approvals for different types of projects. So they have a standard permit that allows sort of relatively large scale development for an extended or cultivation for an extended period of time. And then they have two classes of experimental permits that allow seaweed farms to be developed on a smaller scale for a shorter period of time. And that those experimental permits generally easier to obtain, quicker to obtain. And having one of those experimental permits allows a developer to sort of experiment with different varieties of seaweed, see what grows well where, see how they can use different approaches, cultivation techniques. And then once they figure all that out, they can apply for the standard permit.
Okay, great. And I would take it that there's differences ultimately then in cost, right, between California and Maine and Alaska.
Yeah, I don't have the figures in front of me, but it is significantly cheaper to obtain permits in both Alaska and Maine than in California. as I said, that environmental review requirement in California is just very, very expensive to comply with for developers.
Okay. So with that in mind, what are some of the recommendations that you set forth in the report in terms of how California might move forward at this point?
Yeah, well, I would say the sort of big key thing we recommend is to really streamline the permitting process. You know, California could choose to follow the Alaska model and provide for sort of parallel simultaneous review of applications by multiple agencies rather than the current staggered approach. That would significantly speed things up. We also propose specifically changes to the existing leasing framework. As I said, developers have to obtain this lease from the California Fish and Game Commission. And the legislation that provides for the issuance of those leases says that the commission can issue them when they're in the public interest. But the commission hasn't provided any guidance on how it evaluates what's in the public interest, what factors it will look at. Just sort of does that on an ad hoc basis. And so it creates a lot of uncertainty for developers and really is compounded by the fact that the commission hasn't issued any new leases for seaweed farms in the last 20-odd years. So wow. Developers really have no idea how the commission's going to approach their application. So we recommend that the commission establish set criteria for assessing that public interest. And in particular, you know, we think it's important that the commission not just focus on the environmental risks associated with these projects, but also recognize their potential environmental benefits. I think often with, you know, ocean CDR more broadly, we tend to focus on the environmental risks that these projects present, but we fail to recognize that, you know, these could have a big benefit in terms of helping to mitigate climate change and all the environmental risks that come along with climate change, particularly for ocean ecosystems.
Yeah,
so it's going to be really important, I think.
That's a really interesting question. You know, do you know if in Maine and Alaska, if they have any kind of comparative sort of risk assessment, right? Because I think this is an issue that is going to arise with virtually all ocean-based CDR approaches and probably most of the land-based ones, right? Because all of these, by definition, pose risks, have impacts, right? You know, so does unchecked climate change, right? And so one would hope that there was a process for doing that, right? But I'm not so certain that it's true. Do you know if Alaska and Maine take that approach?
Well, none of the projects that have been developed in Alaska or Maine so far have been for the purposes of carbon removal. Mm-hmm. So sort of the climate benefits of those projects really haven't, I don't think, been evaluated by the agencies. One place where there is at least a framework to enable that sort of comparative assessment is in Canada and their Environmental Protection Act, specifically the provisions of that act dealing with ocean dumping, which could apply to things like ocean fertilization or ocean alkalinity enhancement. Mm-hmm. They have a specific provision in there that says that when they're evaluating the public interest, they have to take into account climate impacts, both positive and negative. And so I think that could facilitate this type of comparative risk assessment where, you know, the status quo is not necessarily the current, just a continuation of the current situation. The status quo that we're comparing against is really a world with intensified climate impacts and all of the consequences that has for ocean environments.
Yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting question, you know, and of course it can go too far, right? Because there's a third way, right? You can argue that the alternative is not necessarily unchecked climate change. It's reducing emissions or taking other approaches, right, that might have fewer risks than these approaches, right? So it becomes extremely complicated, right, in terms of what gets fed into that risk assessment matrix, right? But it's probably no getting away from it at this point. So another project for Sabin, I think, in the future.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's really challenging to figure out what you should be comparing the risks of these activities against.
Yeah.
you know, because we don't know, we hope that emissions will come down rapidly and significantly, but we don't necessarily know that will happen. We also know that some degree of climate change impacts are already locked in. So there's a lot of really difficult sort of trade-offs really for government agencies and for regulators thinking about some of these approaches.
Yeah, it's an interesting sub-question. So those are some of the recommendations that you make for California. One thing I want to tease out, because I'm sure a question that some people have is, well, you know, mainstreaming isn't necessarily always a good thing, right? Sometimes it means that regulators are falling prey to corporate capture or pressures for economic development in a way that can be detrimental to ocean ecosystems, right? And California, of course, also has a history of being extremely careful in protecting its coastline for obvious reasons. Do you think there are any dangers associated with streamlining this process in the ways that Maine and Alaska has done in the context of ocean CDR development?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point because, you know, all of these permitting and environmental review requirements, I've been maybe negative about them, but they serve a really important purpose in terms of giving the opportunity and giving the government an opportunity to review these activities and making sure that they won't cause more harm than good. So, you know, it's certainly very important that we maintain some controls on these activities and make sure that they occur in a sort of safe and responsible way. Some of the other recommendations that we make in the report are around sort of streamlining the environmental review process, which I think if taken too far could present real problems. You know, we talk about the potential for excluding certain, you know, very small scale seaweed cultivation projects from environmental review under CEQA, the State Environmental Quality Act. And say that, you know, you could potentially exclude them from the requirement to do environmental review on the basis that they don't present significant environmental risks. I think that would be very controversial. I think it would be, you know, potentially there would be risks associated with that in terms of people trying to take, you know, developers and bad actors trying to take advantage of that. But I do think there are, you know, changes that can be made to the system to, you know, facilitate these activities whilst keeping appropriate safeguards in place.
Has Sabin had any communications with state officials in California or any reactions to the report from them?
We had a number of conversations with state officials while we were drafting the report. You know, they were sort of very interested in our work and recognized that there are gaps in their existing framework and problems with their existing framework that they need to address. You know, we're still, I would say, socializing the recommendations within the state and seeing if we can, you know, prompt any movement. But certainly there is, I think, a lot of developer interest in this space. And so if this is something that the state, you know, takes up and addresses some of these regulatory challenges, the state could see a lot of development in this space and a lot of money going into this space.
Yeah, that's good to hear. One of the frustrations I often have, not only in the CDR world, but just more generally, is a lot of this good academic research, in my mind, never really ends up in the hands of potential policymakers, right? And that's unfortunate, right? Not that everything that we do in academia is the voice of God, but you know, sometimes there are things that might be good to be taken up, and it's good to hear that there's been that kind of communication. The last thing I wanted to ask you was to put in a bit of a plug for some of the work that Sabin is doing now in the future in this context. What are some of the things that you and others at Sabin are working on in the context of ocean-based CDR that we should be looking out for in the future?
Yeah, thanks. So we're just wrapping up a project, actually, that's looking at the existing legal framework for various ocean CDR techniques at the international level and domestically in 7 countries around the world, so North America, Europe, and Asia. All of that work is going to be published in a book that will hopefully be released later this year. We just submitted the manuscript to the publisher last week. It includes really deep dives into how existing international agreements and customary international law apply to ocean CDR, how, you know, existing domestic US environmental law applies, and similar deep dives into domestic laws in several other countries. Building on that work, we're embarking on a new project that's aimed at developing what we're calling model laws for ocean CDR research. And the goal there is to develop basically federal legislation that could be enacted by Congress that would create effectively sort of a permitting and review framework for ocean CDR research. So not deployment, because we recognize that we're not at the point yet to go ahead with deployment, but there is a need for research. How do we create a regulatory and legal framework that facilitates necessary research whilst ensuring that it occurs in a safe and responsible manner that, you know, adequately manages and mitigates environmental risks, that takes into account the views and perspectives of, you know, local communities and other stakeholders. So that's our next sort of big piece of work around ocean CDR. We also have a number of projects around sort of carbon removal and carbon capture and storage more generally that sort of touch on some related issues. Seems to be an ever increasing field, as I'm sure you know, Will.
Yeah, that's great. I really encourage listeners to follow the work of Sabin. I think one of the groups that can really benefit from this are project developers. I spend a lot of time with startup companies, and one of the constant frustration of startup companies is they realize there's a regulatory environment out there that they're going to have to deal with, or probably already should have started dealing with, but a lot of them simply don't have the luxury, given the capital burn for R&D, to take on legal counsel, right? And that could really hurt them down the road, right? And so I think a lot of what Sabin is doing in terms of starting to outline what this regulatory environment looks like at the international level and at the domestic level, and then, you know, the subnational level, is really important sort of information that, if nothing else, startup companies can use to communicate with outside counsel, and outside counsel can get up to speed much more quickly, because in a lot of times these firms don't have a whole lot of background with CDR, and it's good to have somebody that's hyper specialized on that. So definitely encourage, especially folks on the in the business side, to check out what Sabin is doing. Anything else, Romani, before we wrap up?
No, just echo your last comment. You know, I think this is really a field where the sort of science and engineering is out ahead of the law and policy work, and we really need to bring the various pieces together. So happy to play a small part in that, and look forward to continued discussions really across the whole field.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good place to wrap it up. Once again, I'd like to thank Romani Webb at the Sabin Center for joining us. And I'd like to thank our audience also for joining us, and hope that you will come back in the future. Bye now.